Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Frisch. The Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. The second case this morning is A22-0577, State of Minnesota versus Braxton Monty Anderson.
Good morning. I want to thank you all first off for participating in our remote arguments this morning, and I have some opening remarks to keep in mind. First of all, you should be able to see the clock, and if you're having trouble seeing it, sometimes it helps to toggle from active speaker view to the gallery view, but make sure you know how much time is remaining and that you can see that clock before you begin, please. In addition, we all understand that because of the nature of these remote arguments, that there are interruptions and sometimes technical difficulties. We'll do our best to limit those, but we do understand that they happen and we'll accommodate you to make sure you have all the time to which you're entitled to present your arguments this morning. I also want to make a comment that we're making an audio recording of the proceeding today, and that is the only recording that's permitted. And last, before we begin, please let us know how to pronounce your name and your client's name, as well as if there's any other information you want us to have about how we can refer to you and your client. With that, Mr. Spurbeck, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Roy Spurbeck, and I represent the appellant Braxton Anderson. The issue in this appeal is whether the court on remand erred when it did not sentence appellant to the presumptive middle of the box sentence. This case has been to the Court of Appeals once and then back for the resentencing. It is important, I think, to understand both the procedural history of that and really what happened at the first sentencing. Appellant was convicted after a jury trial of criminal vehicular homicide. The original pre-sentence investigation accorded him two criminal history points. So it's a level 8 offense with 2 points. That meant the guideline range was 58 months to 81 months, with the midpoint being 68 months. So at this original sentencing, Judge Knutson is presiding. He is the judge that presides over the trial, inside some pretrial hearings and the trial, and he is there for the original sentencing. Now, there are three important aspects of this first sentencing. The first is that Judge Knutson denies the appellant's motion for a downward durational departure, saying something to the effect of, I don't think this case is any less serious than the normal, typical criminal vehicular homicide case under this provision of the statute, negligence with a controlled substance in the system. The second part of that sentencing, and I think this is very important, is that the state asks for the longest possible guideline sentence it can get without a departure, and that is 81 months. The judge, though, he rejects that. So at this point, we have the Judge Knutson, who is set for the
trial. But he rejects it, and he says that 68 months is the appropriate sentence in this case. That's what he says.
He says, right? let's quote it, because I think it's important.
He says, in this case, the appropriate sentence is 68 months. That's the quote, right?
Well, there's more to it, though, right? Which is the presumptive guideline sentence for this offense. So it's not just him picking 68 months out of the air. There's not a magic 68 number in this case. 68 is the guideline, the midpoint guideline sentence.
And so Mr. Spurbeck, 68 months is also a guideline sentence on remand, correct?
Correct. And let's move to that. On remand, Judge Knutson has retired.
I want you to get to that, but I do want to follow up a bit, because it seems to me that there's still a bit of an inference or a gap, if you will, between the quote that you read and the argument that you're making, because it's the district court, unless there's some other quote, doesn't specifically say midpoint, right? And doesn't say I'm sentencing him. And at the initial sentencing, doesn't say I'm sentencing him to 68 because I think the midpoint is appropriate, right? And maybe I'm missing it, but I want to follow up to see just so I'm sure. But when I reviewed it, I didn't see those words, and so that's kind of the connection there that I see the argument making that seems to go one step further than just the plain that quote.
Yeah, I don't think there's another quote. I think, though, that we have to remember, and I'll see if I can find the language here, that what the Supreme Court, how they explain it is, the quote, the middle number is what might be referred to as the presumptive fixed sentence. Again, I know he says, in this case, the appropriate sentence is 68 months, which is the presumptive guideline sentence. If you are asking, does he ever say, I'm imposing the middle of the box sentence because the middle of the box sentence is the perfect sentence? No, he doesn't say that. But in the context of it, he has rejected the downward durational departure. He has rejected the top of the box. The idea that he is picking 68 out of the air, I don't think is borne out by the record.
But Mr. Spurbeck, you know, again, the lack of him, you know, the district court saying I'm picking this because it is the midpoint. I mean, doesn't that point out why we so rarely disturb a sentence that is within the guidelines, and the guidelines being a range of months?
Maybe I missed the first part of your question, Your Honor. Can you ask it again?
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, you're already talking about the different things the district court could have been thinking and what the context was and why 68 was the number that the district court picked. I mean, it doesn't, the fact that there's some speculation and uncertainty really support the notion that we as a reviewing court rarely disturb a sentence so long as it is in the guideline range, which is a range of months, not just the midpoint.
Yeah, and I think I don't disagree with that. And I think there are a couple points to that. One, if Judge Knudsen had been the judge at the resentencing and he had said, you know what, I've thought about this, I'm going to give him 68. I don't think there's anything to appeal here. But it's hard for me to square the Supreme Court's case law of why we defer to trial judges who sit through the trial and then do the sentencing. It's because they are familiar with all aspects of the case.
But when this came back for resentencing, are you suggesting that the district court judge, now a different judge, didn't have full discretion to impose the sentence?
You know, actually, I think the discretion is a little more limited given on what the first judge said, and the second judge didn't sit through the trial. Now, this is where I think it's problematic.
Can you tell me what your best case is that would support that legal proposition?
That
a successor sentencing judge's discretion is more limited under circumstances such as these.
I don't know that there's a great case for it. I think this is a super odd factual scenario. You know, given the thousands of unpublished cases, maybe it exists out there. Adverse to me.
Well, Mr. Spurbeck, all three of us have previously been district court judges, and I'm assuming, given the frequency with which I was sentencing defendants who either had a trial in front of a different judge and that judge had moved on to another assignment or retired, or maybe there was a remand. But the act of sentencing without having sat through the trial is not that uncommon. So I do want to emphasize that question, that it's not so rare. And I am wondering the same thing. What is the basis to conclude that the sentencing discretion or the deference that we give to a district court judge at the sentencing stage is somehow different in our review now than it would have been in the initial stage? What's the basis for that?
You know, I think the deference is, I think, less because the judge at the second sentencing.
Well, I understand you think that. I'm asking, what's the basis for that? What's the legal authority, not just logic or the argument that you're making?
Well, I like the argument to be based on logic in the first bit. So if you think it's logical, I'm happy I've made my point. But no, I think one of the things I think we forget in appeals and sentencing, both to the Court of Appeals and to the Supreme Court, is that this is driven by a statute. Because prior to the sentencing guidelines, you couldn't appeal your sentence unless it exceeded the statutory maximum or it violated the Eighth Amendment. So once we moved to a guideline system and the legislature enacted 244 to allow the appeals for sentencing, it is an extremely broad mandate that it gives this court to review sentences. And it includes, it's just inappropriate, right? So we have a very unusual set of circumstances here where we have the first judge really explaining what he's doing. And then we have a and what he thinks the guidelines are. And then we have a remand where the presumptive criminal history or the presumptive sentence shifts because of a lower of the criminal history score. And instead of looking at what the first judge did, which I think we should, because this is the
okay, so let's get back to that point again, because I'm not aware of any authority, whether it's statutory or court-created authority, that even suggests, much less requires, a successor judge to go back to the first judge at sentencing and figure out what was the reasoning behind that judge's decision and limit itself to something. I'm not aware of that. So that's why I'm asking those questions, because I want to know what is the authority. Your logic is sound, but that's only one part of the picture, right?
Again, I don't believe there is a lot of authority on this, because I understand that different judges will sentence on remand, or a different judge sits through the trial, takes the verdict, and then another judge does the sentencing. I just don't think the sequence that we're looking at right now is actually that common. I agree that other judges sometimes sentence. I have no quarrel with that proposition. But here we have a very different thing that's happening, because it's not just the judge in the, like a different judge, say Judge Brian, that, you know, that I know you were in Ramsey. I'm just trying blanking on a different.
No, I understand. I guess I'm asking a specific question about what authority is there that the second judge, and let's assume we're keeping it narrow and into the context of a remand, right? Which I agree happens much less frequently, but it does happen. And, you know, probably dozens of times a year that we have cases regarding sentencing issues that might get remanded. And let's assume that they were keeping it narrow to remand to a different judge. What authority is there that says that judge has to, or even authority suggesting, much less requiring, that judge look to the reasoning of the initial sentencing? Where's that authority?
You know, I don't know that authority exists, but I don't think it exists because it's wrong. I think it doesn't exist because it doesn't happen, or it happens very rarely. Now, I mean, there's a whole host of scenarios here that basically make it so there's no appeal in this case. You know, there's all kinds of things that could have happened, even with the second judge. You know, I think one of the compounding problems here is that we don't know why Judge Helgeson gives him 68 months, because he doesn't say.
Can I ask that? I'm trying to chase down the rule of law that you're asking us to adopt here, which I think is a matter of first impression. And I'm wondering if it works the other way. For example, say the original judge grants a downward dispositional departure using an incorrect criminal history score. It's appealed or denies a downward dispositional departure, and it's appealed, and the criminal history, it's remanded, like in this case, and then the departure motion is renewed and it's granted. Does the state have an appeal right because the original judge denied the departure and the successor judge granted the departure under your logic?
I think actually in that scenario, the criminal history score wouldn't change the reasons for a dispositional departure. So the state's argument on appeal actually would be law of case. So actually, I'm sure there is a scenario.
Mr. Spurbeck, I do want to hear the answer to the question. The crux of the question is, does it work both ways? Is the rule of law you're asking us to impose, does it work both ways? And maybe you're right that the criminal history score, put that aside, there is a basis to deny, it's denied, it's appealed, the second judge grants it. Is that a problem, I think, is the question.
Yeah, I think actually it works both ways. And I'm happy to address those. If I was on the other side, if I was a state sentencing appeal, I'd be happy to be on the other side of it, but it works both ways. Absolutely. So,
and I just want to circle back to my original question. Do you have, what is your best case, your best authority that would support the proposition that you're asking us to adopt?
The best authority that supports the proposition is the Supreme Court opinion in State versus Huff, which deals with the very specific reason we defer to the trial judge who sits through the trial, is what that opinion says. The second part of the authority would be the really robust review that is allowed under the statute for sentences. I think you put those together and you have a reason that this could be that in this. I'm not going to say it's unique because that would mean there's one time it's happened. I can't say that this scenario hasn't happened, but I got to tell you, it is super unusual. I mean, I've had this job for 20 years. I have done, I don't know, a lot of sentencing appeals. I've never had this come up like this. It's very, very unusual. I would like to point out that, you know, if the judge had given him the top of the box sentence the first time through, Judge Knutson had given him 81, I'm 100% sure the attorney general would have said to the judge at the second hearing, give him the top of the box. That's what Judge Knutson did, right? That's my argument, that he got the middle, that the judge specifically chose the middle, and that should be the sentence on remand. Compounding this is that the second judge, Judge Helgeson, doesn't explain why he's giving him 68 months, which is almost the top of the box. And the reason he can't give him any more is because the case law wouldn't allow a longer sentence on remand because it punishes him for the appeal. So I think taken together, that this is the very rare case where this court can exercise its discretion and remand for resentencing to 58 months, because that's what looks like Judge Knutson would have done had he done the resentencing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Spurbeck. Mr. Magnuson.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota, in this case. I want to cover two points this morning. First is that there are no grounds for reversing the resentencing court's decision to impose a 68-month sentence. I have to kind of concede that practically everything I was going to say has been covered in the court's questions to appellant's counsel. I don't think there is any case law that supports the proposition that this court can insert itself into the resentencing court's mind and tell the court that they did something wrong. There was no error here. So it really comes down to that the second argument as to whether the resentencing judge, that person's discretion was limited. And I think it's hard to square appellant's initial concession that if Judge Helgeson had resentenced, he wouldn't have an appeal here because he would have been able to exercise his discretion and reimpose 68 months. Yet somehow, if a different court judge does resentencing, now all of a sudden that judge has no discretion to resentence differently than the first judge. And I will echo.
Mr. Magnuson, do you want to address the adequacy of the sentencing judge's rationale for the imposition of 68 months on remand?
Well, as this court has said on numerous occasions, the Supreme Court has said on numerous occasions, a district court judge does not have to give any reasons for imposing a guideline sentence. And many of the cases that are cited involve a district court judge that has denied a dispositional or durational departure. Here, there was a durational departure made at the initial sentencing, but there was no departure motion made at the resentencing. So the district court in the resentencing didn't have to state any reasons for why it was doing what it did because there was no departure motion in front of it. It simply imposed the guideline sentence.
I mean, I appreciate that. And I know that is our case law. I think what Mr. Spurbeck is arguing is that we have a little bit of a different situation where judge number one picks the midpoint in the box for the sentence. Judge number two is picking a high point in the box for the sentence without additional explanation as to why the sentence on remand is imposed. Perhaps a more severe sentence given the range. And so under those circumstances, are we looking at some additional requirement for a district court judge to explain itself in the imposition of sentence on remand?
I don't think so. As the panel covered with appellant in the initial questioning, it's difficult to discern exactly what Judge Helgeson was thinking when he imposed that initial 68-month sentence. As you look at that entire quote, in this, and this is from page 24, in this case, the appropriate sentence is 68 months, which is the presumptive guideline sentence for this offense, and it takes into account prior criminal history, and it takes into account the seriousness of the offense. So he says this is the appropriate sentence. So that's the first part is we're presuming that we know what Judge Helgeson was thinking. But even if we do presume that we know what Judge Helgeson was thinking, there is no authority that his thought process then somehow binds another judge. And that if that was the case, then this court, when it remanded, could have remanded and simply said, impose this sentence. But that isn't what this court did.
So, Mr. Magnuson, it wouldn't make any difference to you then if the initial sentencing judge had said, I'm sentencing you to 68 months. That's an appropriate sentence because it is the midpoint of the box. And whatever the box would have been based on criminal history, I would sentence you to the midpoint because of the nature of your offense. And then the second judge says, I'm sentencing you to the highest possible sentence because I think this is outside the most typical, and so I'm going to give you this as much as I can. It wouldn't make any difference if that was our facts. You still would say that the second judge has complete, brand new tabula rasa authority to and discretion that we would defer to.
Yes, I would have to concede that because it, you know, the situation may well come about where the obverse would happen. A resentencing judge would decide, I don't think this is as serious an offense. I think I'm going to go down to the bottom of the box and I'm not going to impose that sentence. It's an exercise of a correct exercise of the authority and the discretion that the guidelines and the appellate courts have given to sentencing judges.
And so what do you make of the best case from Mr. Spurbeck, the argument that the explanation for our deference to a sentencing judge is the fact that they sat through a trial?
Well, I think most of that, again, comes up in the context of departure motions. I just don't know that there's a lot of case law out there that talks about what a district court judge does when they just simply impose a guideline sentence and don't deny either the state or the defendant's departure motion. State v. Delk, I think, is very much on point. The one case that is cited by, it's the non-precedential case cited by appellant, the State v. Curtis case, I don't find that that's helpful at all. In that case, the defendant was convicted of stealing, I think, 17 bottles of beer and was given a 32 or 33 month sentence. This court on appeal felt that that was excessive and that the district court needed to go back and look at that. I think looking at that now, we can maybe see that 33 months for 17 bottles of beer is certainly excessive. I can see why the district or the court of appeals thought that back then, but this is nowhere.
Do you agree that the rationale for deferring to a trial court judge at the time of sentencing is tied to that judge presiding over a trial?
I think the underlying basis for that is because the judge is familiar with the facts. This court's opinion and this court's decision that laid out the facts in Braxton Anderson 1 was attached to the state's sentencing memorandum. And I'm going to assume, the district court said that the resentencing court said that they had reviewed the state's sentencing court memorandum. So that contains the relevant facts of the case. I don't think you had to sit through the trial to really discern what are the relevant factors in this case. The relevant factors are that that Mr. Anderson used methamphetamine and then drove poorly, and it resulted in the tragic death of the victim in this case. So I don't think this is a difficult, complex case that is beyond the ken of a recent.
Do you think that the rationale tying the discretion of a sentencing court to presiding over a trial, do you think there's a difference in the deference that we should give a sentencing court who's sentencing after a plea versus a district court who's sentencing after a trial? Or should it be the same degree of deference?
Oh, well, that's interesting. But I don't think it really changes the analysis, you know, that district courts aren't supposed to get involved in pleas. Maybe there's some pushing and shoving or nudging along the way, but district court judges aren't supposed to be actively involved in pleas. They can listen to a plea colloquy. They can listen to the statements, the arguments made by counsel and any victim impact statements. But I don't know that being in the court as opposed to rereading that in a transcript really changes the deference that this court should give. If there are no other questions on that, the second point that I wanted to get to was the interim guidance that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission gave out and that the probation officer relied on. It purports to be guidance, and as I pointed out in my brief to the court, I think it's slanted. It is not fair, even-handed. I'm looking at the bottom of the first page. In the absence of sentencing guidelines policy, comma, and in light of the recent Court of Appeals decision in State v. Eubanks, comma. Well, Braxton Anderson was even more recent than Eubanks. I think Eubanks was issued in February of 2021, and Braxton Anderson came out in November of 2021. So if we're going to talk about recent cases, Braxton Anderson's case was more recent, yet it's not mentioned in the guideline, in the commission's guidance. That, I think, is troubling. More importantly, it results in the reduction of a person's sentence. And as I mentioned in my brief, Minnesota Statute 244.09 Subdivision 11 doesn't allow the Sentencing Commission, Guidelines Commission, to do that. They can't unilaterally do it. And that's what they've done here under the guise of providing guidance to the court. And again, I highlighted the language. They tell district courts the partial point must be disregarded. That is specifically contrary to the language in the sentencing guidelines themselves. The Guidelines Commission had no authority to issue that guidance.
So I don't understand as a legal proposition what you suggest we do with a partial custody point. I mean, the grid is, if you have a criminal history score of 1, X. If you have a criminal history score of 2, Y. There's no criminal history score of 1.5 box. So
well, that's correct.
What do you want us to do with a partial point as a practical matter?
Well, you know, my wife's not an attorney, but you know, I laid these things down. We've got one point is 58, 2 points is 68. What would you say the point should be for 1.5? Well, 63, you know, it's the midpoint, and the guidelines themselves and the statute then say, once you've identified what that is, we go 15% below and 20% above.
What's your best authority for that, Mr. Magnuson?
That I have no authority for.
Because other than your wife, you do have some authority for it.
Yes.
So don't say one.
Well, that maybe has an impact on me personally, but it doesn't on this court, obviously. But it's common sense. And at the end of the day, we know what the guidelines purport to do. They provide advice to the courts. And I think the sentencing guidelines in their interim guidance should have done just that. They should have provided guidance to district courts on how to apply the 1.5. And I think they failed when they did that, when they issued that guidance. But the second court maybe thought, you know, I do have to take this half custody status point into account, so I'm going to impose the 68. And that would have been just fine for the resentencing court to do.
We would have to speculate, because that's not what.
Correct. As I was starting to say, we don't know, because the resentencing court didn't say. But if the resentencing court thought that and did that, there wouldn't be any problem with it. I'm almost out of time. If the court has any other questions for me, otherwise I will cede the last 45 seconds. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Spurbeck.
You know, rebuttal, please. Yeah, just super quickly. I think Mr. Magnuson maybe got turned around on the judges' names. Judge Helgeson is the second judge. Judge Knutson is the first judge. I think I just so we're clear. Curtis, which I do cite, it's a published Court of Appeals opinion. I think the state said it's non-precedential. That's incorrect. And the last, I guess, thing with this is, this kind of second half of the state's argument about, well, really the criminal history score is 1.5. There are a couple parts of this. Judge Helgeson said the defendant's criminal history score was 1.
Just a second, Mr. Spurbeck, can I just jump in real quick as a threshold matter? Is this the kind of thing that required a notice of related appeal, and is there one?
I was just going to say the state did not file a notice of appeal from that. It is an adverse ruling by the trial judge. If the state were to succeed in front of this court with an argument that it's 1.5, that would expand the relief. So it can't be an alternative argument, because it's more relief, especially as you listen to the idea of we're going to make up our own guidelines. So I'm not really sure that, I mean, I know this is kind of a secondary argument from the state. I don't think it's really correctly before the court, because there is no notice of appeal. The thing that the state did not mention during their argument is this court has a published opinion in Bjanovich, which says disregard the half point. It's also not cited in the brief. So I feel like you can't just criticize the commission without addressing the fact that this court has adopted that reasoning in a published opinion, which the state did not do a petition for review. In fact, if you look at the Bjanovich brief, they conceded the half point issue. So I think taken together, I don't think the half point, this 1.5, is correctly before the court. I think it's been rejected. I don't think it's law of the case. I don't think it has anything to do with this. So all I'm simply asking the court today is, when we look at where we give the deference, it seems to me that where we give deference is, one, where the trial judge is the one doing the sentencing. And second, if we have a different judge, the place where you might get some deference is where the judge explains why he picks the sentence he picks. I'm very aware of the case law that talks about, well, if you're in the range, you don't really need to say. But I think if you go back and look through those cases, what they are doing is distinguishing between the old case, well, it's still a current case law, of the judge having to announce departure reasons. And they're contrasting it with that of, well, you don't have to give a departure reason to give the top of the box.
So, Mr. Spurbeck, is there a more narrow proposition than that you're asking us to reach or to?
You know, the more narrow relief in this case is a remand to have Judge Helgeson explain why he gave 68.
The proposition of law would be, if you're a successor judge.
The successor judge, especially when they have quite a bit of language and rulings from the first judge, like here, you need to tell us why you're giving. Okay.
There's an exception to those cases that say you don't have to explain if you're a successor judge.
Absolutely. And
is that true, Mr. Spurbeck, even whereas here the successor judge conducted a full-blown resentencing hearing where it heard from the victim and probation and everybody and took in all that information?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, I will say one of the things about this resentencing hearing is it ends up being a little one-sided, doesn't it? Because we're going to do victim impact statements again, but we're not going to do the durational departure motion again because it's barred by law of the case. So this sentencing hearing really ends up being quite prosecution oriented. Now, there's no objection to that. I'm not arguing that. I'm just noting it. But I'm not sure how much deference, again, is owed here, because Judge Helgeson isn't in any better position to know the facts of the case than this court is, right? Because you're both, that assumes that Judge Helgeson looked at the opinion or the transcripts from the jury trial and not just the state's memo.
It also assumes that the only rationale for our deference to the district court is somehow their position at the time, being able to see people's faces and whatnot. And there might be other rationales that go into that decision to apply one standard of review versus a different one.
Yeah, no, I think there are some rationales that go to the standard of review. I think here those rationales cut in favor of a more plenary standard of review and less deference in this case. So I'm out of time. Thank you very much. I would just ask for the court to reverse for an order the presumptive 58-month sentence, and if not, to remand for Judge Helgeson to explain why he announced 68. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank counsel for your briefs and your thoughtful arguments this morning. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you both. Have a nice day.